Welcome to Legal News and Review, recipient of the Florida Bar Award of Excellence, and featuring Michael Santucci, co-chair of the Intellectual Property Division of the Broward Bar. From the law firm of Santucci Priori, practicing intellectual property, business, and entertainment law and litigation, located in downtown Fort Lauderdale. Legal News and Review, the only real problem solver radio program using the law, with your moderator, Philip Bell, and hosts and legal panel attorney, Gary Singer, chair of the Broward County Bar Association's Real Property Section. Gary Singer is board certified in real estate law and a syndicated columnist from the Sun Sentinel. He is an expert in his field of practice. Now, here's your moderator, Philip Bell.
On the docket for today's broadcast, after representing various airports and aircraft manufacturers in civil litigation in both state and federal courts, attorney Carrie Dowling now focuses her practice on aviation transaction law. From Air Law Office, we're going to be speaking with Carrie Dowling. First, good afternoon to my legal panel host, Gary Singer. Good afternoon.
Hey, how you doing this week, Phil?
And good afternoon to Mike Santucci.
Great to be here, Phil.
And, of course, we're very pleased to have Gary Astro. For those listeners, remember him. Don't just ask him about the death penalty.
We'll be okay. Anything but that goes.
Let's stay off Absolutely. That today, please.
Well, up and away, gentlemen. Let's fly into this segment. I'd like to say a very good afternoon to Carrie Dowling.
Good afternoon, Phil. Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, you have a dynamic practice, and aviation transaction law is really, it's an international arena of practice. And in general, there's several questions that come to mind that we have for you, and some of it is very fascinating when it comes to transaction law. And, of course, Gary's going to get to his 1031. I see that in your eye. But generally, why should I hire a U.S. counsel for an aircraft that I intend to operate outside the U.S.?
Well, many aircraft that are used for general aviation, as my practice focuses on general aviation, that's private use aircraft owned by individuals or corporations, have contact with many different countries during either their ownership structure formation or for their operational structure. And having a U.S.-based lawyer allows the aircraft owner to more effectively control the value of the aircraft and to always be concerned about and looking forward to the resale value when their time comes to sell the aircraft or to upgrade. The general rule of thumb worldwide is that an aircraft that maintains contact with the U.S. enjoys a much higher resale value than aircraft that spend any significant amount of time outside of the U.S. from a maintenance perspective or from an overall operational perspective.
So it actually retains more value.
It does indeed. Now, of course, that's going to carve out aircraft that are born in and used their entire lifespan in a different country. But for aircraft that are going to come in and out of the U.S., to maintain that contact with the U.S. and to maintain that chain over the useful life of the aircraft, it maintains a higher resale value.
And we're talking about corporate jets, jets that actually can travel overseas.
Indeed.
And interesting enough, in the luxury yacht business, a lot of the registries are offshore, out of the United States. Mm-hmm. And they do offer a registry. It's called the International Aircraft Registry, correct?
Correct. So the International Aircraft Registry is a way for an owner to, or someone with an interest in aircraft, to put the world on notice that they have an interest in the aircraft. As the other members of the panel can attest, as the other members of the panels can attest, the rules governing priority of interest in an asset are the rules change with each jurisdiction. So it's very difficult for an owner to be able to land in Spain or Portugal or Venezuela or in Europe and maintain an ability to show that they have an ownership interest in the aircraft because their local law may have some variances. So back in 2006, a treaty was signed, often referred to as the Cape Town Convention.
Right.
And that treaty was an international registry where I can tell the world I own this airplane, or you as a lender can tell the world I have an interest in this airplane. So then anywhere in the world the aircraft lands, everybody knows this is this person's airplane. So if someone comes to try to assert an interest, we can go to the registry and say, this aircraft is registered in the U.S. to John Smith, and he's the owner.
So you don't have to write Trump on the side to let everybody know?
You don't. You can if you'd like to, but might not be the best decision these days.
Is the registry mandatory?
The registry is not mandatory. So many, at this point, there are still a number of jurisdictions that are still signing the convention, or signing the treaty, excuse me. But some jurisdictions don't have a mechanism yet to enforce to allow the owner to enforce their right. There's, for example, Brazil signed the convention 5 or 6 years ago, but only within the last 6 months has a mechanism available for their owners to log their interest with the international registry.
And for the students that are listening at different universities, college schools of law, such as NOVA, you have a fascinating practice, really. I mean, you travel all around the world. And I don't want to say you work with the rich and famous, but let's face it, you got to have a certain amount of money behind you to have a private jet.
So we
or a helicopter.
Or a helicopter. We refer to our clients as high net worth individuals, and these people are, like you said, all over the world. I have clients in Indonesia, in South America, in Europe, in Asia. It's a fascinating practice. It's always fun. And I tell people that ask me if I like my job, I'm one of the only lawyers whose clients are always in a good mood.
But it's actually a tool for a lot of businesses, Fortune 500, Fortune 100. And there are a lot of issues when it comes to the maintenance, location, and even charting. Mm-hmm. You can buy the aircraft, and while it's sitting there, you could actually chart it out, correct?
Correct. So ultimately, the decision on how you're going to operate the aircraft is dictated by what the owner needs from their aircraft. Some owners want to use their aircraft as a tool to increase their business and their ability to be able to conduct business and not lose time during transit. There are other owners who treat it as a toy. It is, however, very expensive to own and operate a jet. And when we're talking about the clients that I have in the aircraft that I typically deal with, we're talking about aircraft that include a LAV and have range that can fly from New York to London nonstop, that many have the ability to have sleeping quarters in them. So you can imagine the cost to operate the aircraft often outpaces the cost of the purchase of the aircraft. So it's important when you're buying to make sure that you understand the use needs so that you can determine how to mitigate that exposure to this excess cost. Many people choose to go the charter route, which is an airline as defined by the FAA, but as you and I would call it, a private airline, as opposed to just using it individually for your business use.
Well, again, they do use it as a tool or a way that they can enjoy themselves. But also, they could also use it as a, could possibly pay for itself, correct?
Well,
or offset some of the hard costs.
To offset some of the hard costs, correct. If anybody is going into the aircraft ownership business with the intent of making money, then I have some swampland I'd like to sell you in the Everglades. Chartering is a way to offset the aircraft. There's also, for larger companies or larger ownership structures, you'll have an umbrella company that will purchase the aircraft, and then their associate companies will lease it from them for use and furtherance of their business, so then you can keep it out of the charter. But you put it on a charter certificate so that when you're not using it, someone else can, and it offsets your hard costs.
Explain to me, when you go into the airports, you don't have to stand in line.
I do not. So I had to go to London on Monday night for a meeting on Tuesday morning and turn around and come back Tuesday night, which sounds a lot more glamorous than it is. But I was disappointed that I didn't get my passport stamped.
Really?
They did, customs didn't. I had to go back and ask if I could stamp my passport. But I didn't have to stand in line in the customs hall, and that was quite lovely.
I've had friends who taken a private jet, and when I say friends, I'm talking about six of them, mm-hmm. and they split the cost.
Absolutely.
And they said it was, you know, they said it wasn't as much more than if I was flying first class.
That's absolutely right. And when you factor in the travel expenses associated with flying commercially, mm-hmm. nowadays you need to be at the aircraft at the airport 2 hours before takeoff, and it's going to take you some time to come get your luggage on the way back. When you factor in those costs of loss of business time, mm-hmm. it often is around the same price as if you were flying first class when you can have a large group.
There's about 18,000 around the world, 18,000 private jets right mm-hmm. now that are flying. I mean, that's tremendous. I know that the yachting industry here in Florida is responsible for over 90,000 jobs, and I'm assuming the private jet industry is similar, a good source of good-paying jobs.
It absolutely is. I don't have the exact numbers with mm-hmm. me, but the state of Florida has been actively studied as a jurisdiction for what general aviation can do for the local economy. And there are some quite interesting studies out there with the dollars that general aviation brings into the South Florida economy with the maintenance that is paid to the dollars that are coming into South Florida for money that is being paid to fixed-base operators that are maintenance operations for anything from maintenance to painting the aircraft to the pilots that live here to the fuel and the tax on the fuel sales. It's quite a boon to the state.
What about I see listed occasionally, I get these reports. I used to subscribe to the Rob Report. I'm sure you know what remember that was.
As
they have planes in there, DuPont Registry. But I see these auctions. I guess they're confiscated from maybe drug runs or some maybe deficiency in payments, but majority, I think, are drug runs. And, you know, it's as is. They buy it at their own risk. And these aren't cheap. I mean, maybe they're $5 million planes.
Mm-hmm. So the aircraft auctions are a little bit different than what you're used to with automobile auctions or other kinds of movable goods. Aircraft auctions, like you said, many of them mm-hmm. are aircraft that were seized for many purposes,
right.
And they are drugs.
As a matter of fact, 2 weeks ago, they found a bunch of cocaine in a plane. In all places, they found it in the nose of the plane.
In the nose.
where
right.
Yeah.
The place they should have looked at.
With the aircraft auction, you're not allowed to look at the airplane. And they may allow you to look around, but you're not going to have an opportunity to look at the logs. And the value of the aircraft is really based in the aircraft logbooks and in the engines. If you don't know before you enter an auction mm-hmm. what's going on with those engines or if the logbooks are complete, then you have no idea if you're buying a $2 million paperweight.
Wow.
So typically the people who are bidding on these auctions are the bank that hold the note, the old owner that wants it back, mm-hmm. the last mechanic that did work on it, because they know what they're
really?
Buying. They know. So you won't see many people that go in and bid on these aircraft that actually have any knowledge about what they're bidding on.
Why would the old owner bid?
If it was an aircraft that was seized, for example, there's the short answer is they have a really huge fine from the FAA, and they can't afford to pay the fine, so they seize the aircraft and auction it so they can get it back cheap.
Oh. They let them do that?
Yes,
because
absolutely.
That's pretty much unlike every other type of auction where you owe money.
How about in real estate?
They can't do that. Yeah. Cannot do that.
Absolutely.
Any
yeah.
other kind of asset I can think of.
Isn't it also true that if you're buying at an auto auction that you're at the same disadvantage unless you're the prior owner, you can't inspect the vehicle, or can you, prior to making bids on that vehicle?
For an automobile, I don't have the answer to that. I can tell you the difference between an aircraft and an automobile is the automobile, you don't have to have the maintenance records or the logs to have a value. And with the aircraft, without those logs, if you have a $5 million aircraft with logs, it's maybe $2 million without the logs.
But you can inspect those prior to making any bids or
no,
not?
No, you cannot.
So that's the disadvantage.
Right. So you have no idea if the logs are on board or not.
Well, why would they not let you do that? That seems silly.
We're talking about the government.
There's your answer.
Well, no, but typically, even in government auctions, they try to maximize value.
I've not seen a situation where they've given the bidders access to the logs or to look at the engines to see what their status might be.
And they can't even really take off, I believe, what's it called, that housing around?
The cowling. Correct.
They can't take that off, correct?
They cannot.
You can't open it up.
You cannot.
When there's a sale of aircraft, a private sale, you know, owner sells, there's sales tax that applies like any other sale of a good?
There is. Yeah. So as you're well aware, sales tax is a state function. Mm-hmm. So for aircraft that are based in Florida, we have ways that we can mitigate the exposure by paying that tax over time as opposed to a lump sum. Some clients choose to pay the tax as a lump sum up front. Typically what we do is we mitigate it over a 10-year period where you're paying the tax on some lease income as opposed to on the...
Are there rules that govern what jurisdiction's sales tax rate will be applied to the sale? How is that determined?
So the way I refer to it when I'm speaking to my clients is, where does the aircraft most often sleep? So Florida has specific rules as to the number of days number of nights per month that the aircraft sleeps in Florida, and when it's deemed to be based here and when it's deemed to be based somewhere else. There are other jurisdictions like New York that are less stringent and other jurisdictions that are more stringent. So that's an important conversation in the beginning with the client. Where are you going to go? So we can determine where to base it so that we can, again, mitigate your exposure to excess tax.
And that's why your clients come to you. I guess the term would be risk management.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So it's just a sales tax? It's not a dock stamp tax or anything like that?
Well, you would have a dock stamp tax in the event that you were having lending. But just for the straight sale, no, you would not have the
dock
stamps.
So it's basically classified just like a motor vehicle?
Absolutely.
Huh, interesting. Mm-hmm.
Carrie, I have a quick question. I may be violating an NDA here, but I'll take my chances.
Okay.
And you probably haven't heard this before because it's a brand new concept, but I have some friends that designed and created a heliport.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't heard of it before. They've just gotten the patent. In fact, they did a test run recently. That's why I feel comfortable discussing it, because I think there was some media reports about it. But essentially, it's a device where a helicopter can land where ordinarily the landing pads are very limited, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know this is a curveball because you haven't heard this coming and it wasn't part of the syllabus for prep. But how might something like that impact the industry as a whole from your perspective? Because I noticed that helicopters are as much, or maybe not as much, a part of what you do. But other than obviously expanding the horizons, what do you think the implications of that might be legally speaking?
Well, from a legal perspective, the issue is going to be airspace and what kind of routes you'd be able to take if you're going to have a helipad, for example, in downtown Fort Lauderdale, and you need to get to court down in Dade County. So the issue that you're going to have there is the airspace. You're also going to have an issue with helicopters are not as quietly operated as aircraft, so you're going to have some noise abatement issues. I can tell you from experience that other countries that have much more densely populated downtown areas, that's a very popular mechanism that's in place to get around from one business to another. Again, for high-level executives and high-net-worth individuals, where you're going to be in a city that it takes you 2 hours to get from one side to the other, do it in 10 minutes.
Do you think the concept of this helipad, which would be like a seaborne thing somewhere, maybe in the intercoastal mm-hmm. or offshore a little bit, or anywhere where it could manage to be fit in, would be something that could benefit in terms of the, despite the limitations in airspace, increase the ability to land in places where before were prohibited?
My opinion on that is that it is a good opportunity to expand the economic base. And I think that it would be a good opportunity to bring more money and more technology into an area. My realistic thought is that it's unlikely to be as attractive in the U.S. because of the noise abatement issues that we face in this country.
In Dubai, they just tested out a self-driving personal use drone. Mm-hmm. Did you guys hear about that?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And all drones have to be registered. And if something like that comes to the United States, I think you're going to add, you do private jets, you mm-hmm. do helicopters, mm-hmm. and now you're going to do those private drones.
Private drones, right.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go back to school.
We have a leg up. You understand the FAA laws mm-hmm. and governing a host of things that are mm-hmm. required. I mean, there's so much minutia to owning the jet, but that does have, surprising to me, a great life cycle cost, meaning the retention value.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike a car that you drive off, loses half its value almost that day.
Right. An aircraft, really, as long as there isn't any major damage, and major damage is a defined industry term, as long as there's not major damage, really retains its value long term. Again, as long as you can show the maintenance schedules are maintained and that you maximize your value by having a lot of your maintenance done in the U.S. and having English language logbooks. It's a way that you really maintain that value.
Well, like everything else in law, it depends.
Absolutely.
Is it good for me to lease it? Is it good for me to own it outright?
Mm-hmm.
Is it good for me to lease it out, to own it outright and lease it out? Am I forgetting something?
Well, you're not forgetting anything. I think it's important to note here for the listeners and for people that are listening that have clients with aircraft or an interest in aircraft. Mm-hmm. I looked today at my checklist that I have for a straight purchase, which with no bells and whistles, just a straight purchase. There are 79 distinct items on that checklist. That's a lot of things to think about, and you're buying a brand new airplane. You don't want to think about 79 distinct items. You want to take your keys and go flying.
You bet.
So whether you're
not to interrupt you, this is Gary. Do people, it just blew my mind, because I know people for some odd reason think they can buy real estate, even commercial real estate, yeah. or businesses without an attorney.
Yes.
Do people actually try to buy airplanes without an attorney?
True story. Today.
You're not going to say yes, are you?
Today. Oh, I have two separate people came into my office today that bought an aircraft without a lawyer and now spent a bunch
Seriously?
Of money and don't have an airplane.
Mess.
Yep.
Like, $5 million was great, but I didn't want to spend an extra $10,000.
Absolutely. Yes.
Seriously?
All the time. Yep.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Wow. And how did they make that kind of money?
How did the high net worth
individuals?
How did
someone who would think that way make that kind of money?
Lottery.
Seriously.
Oh, cocaine in the nose of the plane.
Yeah. I feel better about the people buying a condo without an attorney. Now.
Right.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. Carrie, I, before we say goodbye, I wanted to thank Pam Stratton from Veritex Legal Solutions.
Oh, you bet.
For bringing the cookies
you.
And the other goodies. They're the largest court reporting company in the country.
But we specifically said gluten-free.
But, Carrie, if someone wanted to reach you, what's the best way to contact you?
The best way to contact me is via email. Without getting into the full email address, it is carriedowling@airlawoffice.com. You can go to my website, which is airlawoffice, airlawoffice.com. Or you can reach me on my office line, which is 954-740-0971. And that rings through to my mobile. So it will be, I will be available to take calls and help and don't get into a position where you bought an airplane without a lawyer.
Right. And Carrie is with a K.
Carrie is with a K, yes.
And that's a great, that's a great domain name. Domain name, airlawoffice.com.
Yes. Yeah, I immediately thought of Airwolf.
I love that.
Yeah.
I'm going to open up a law, air office just so I can have that domain.
There you go. There you go.
Now that's fantastic. Well, I got to tell you, this was very interesting. Hoping someday you help me buy my plane.
Absolutely.
Most likely it'll be a scale model.
Yes.
Just a real estate lawyer, you know. But I want to thank you very much for coming on. It was very, very interesting, Carrie. And I want to thank all of our listeners once again for tuning in and listening to us. On your next plane purchase, please do reach out to Carrie and then pick me up. We'll fly somewhere. But hey, folks, thanks again for listening. Have a great day. And as always,
be legal.
You've been listening to the award-winning Legal News and Review, recognized by the Florida Bar's Award of Excellence. Legal News and Review, featuring Michael Santucci from the law firm of Santucci Priori, located in downtown Fort Lauderdale, and practicing intellectual property, business, and entertainment law and litigation. They can be reached at 500law.com or at 954-351-7474. To contact the legal panel hosts and guests, go to belegalbuzz.com. And to reach Gary Singer, board-certified real estate and syndicated columnist, appearing in 400 media outlets, including the front page of the Money Section every Monday in the Sun Sentinel, from the law firm of Gary M. Singer, PA, call 954-851-1448 for legal news and review. Remember, be legal.
Do you need an attorney? Call someone you can trust. The Broward County Bar Association, a not-for-profit organization, was founded in 1925 to foster courtesy, ethics, and professionalism, as well as to provide necessary legal services throughout South Florida. The Broward County Bar Association, 3,000 members strong, has attorney members that work throughout the entire state of Florida, as well as nationally and internationally. Remember, the Broward County Bar Association is a referral you can count on. Call the Broward County Bar Association at 954-764-8310 for all your legal needs. A referral you can count on. 954-764-8310 or contact online at browardbar.org. Non-lawyer spokesperson.